Hello and welcome to Punching Out. Every week we're here on WAO Radio talking about the problems people have with their work. Whether it's incompetent bosses or unfair policies, hostile workplaces or dismal paychecks, or anything in between, we want to hear from you. If you'd like to share your work problems with us, email us at punchingoutwao@gmail.com and let us talk about them. Tune in and punch out. Your boss isn't listening, but we are.
Hello and welcome to Punching Out. I'm Ryan, joined today by Noah.
Hi, y'all.
And Lou.
Hey, guys.
On today's show, we're going to be discussing a topic that we've decided to term the Long Red Scare. And the thesis of this episode is that the Red Scare, the thing that you were told about, you know, Joseph McCarthy, high school history class, 1950s, you know what it is, didn't fully end in the United States. And that fact has circumscribed our politics in the 70-odd years since. Lou, I think this was your brainchild. So if you want to give more of a pitch here, right as we're starting things off, that'd be appreciated.
Yeah, and heads up, it's tangent time, because this came to me starting when I was thinking. Yeah, it's a very, very normal Lou thing to say. This came to me when I was thinking about the movie Oppenheimer that came out last year, because one of the central theses of that movie is that the leftist-leaning politics of Oppenheimer and those around him basically ended his career in some ways, at least with the Atomic Energy Agency.
Your cat attacking your keyboard right now? Is that what's happening?
She was doing that, yes. Sorry okay. about that. Thankfully, she's cute.
Do you want to take that again?
Was it really that bad?
No, let's leave it in. Yeah. Why not?
The cat's a leftist as well. It seems she's
Are you sure about this?
I'm hoping. Anyway, the point is that it got me thinking about how the effects of the Red Scare led to situations in government and in labor widely, not just in people who work for the government, but all people who work, where it self-selects for people who have right ideologies. And by right, I mean like conservative ideologies, because we are limited in what we can say. Like all three of us here have to be really careful, but with who we talk about with in terms of this within our workplaces, or we risk losing our jobs. And that was the case during the Red Scare. I would argue it was the case all the way since then, because it is strongly limited what we can and cannot say in the workplace.
Yeah. Funnily enough, Oppenheimer came to mind for me as well today as I was considering angles to take in this episode. I don't know. I saw a tweet about how his politics got sort of shunted off, and so people with really bad ideas got to control our nuclear weapons, which ultimately not very good in the long run.
That was exactly my thought process too, was that like it self-selects for people who are going to be more aggressive in their use of nuclear weapons because they are buying into the ideology and premise that nuclear weapons are defensive and should be used for those purposes. Which is, we can all agree, wrong and not correct, but that is not the ideology that somebody who is right of us, which is a lot of people, would think. And therefore, it has skewed who can work for government and what the policies out of government are going to be in this particular sense, but like broadly as well.
Christopher Nolan's like progress as like a socially conscientious filmmaker has at this point gone from like making Occupy Wall Street the villain of a movie to basing a movie on a biography that makes the explicit point that the Red Scare deprived America of an intellectual class that could influence its political and social progress. That going after people, not just Oppenheimer, but, you know, suspected and actual now and again communists in diplomacy, in science, in education, in law, in what films, have you.
Everything.
Sure. Yeah. In every aspect of American politics and culture, in any kind of industry that had a capacity for dissemination, ultimately served to make the U.S. a more aggressive, more narrow-minded place. And we really only grapple with that in terms of how that affected domestic politics. You know, we'll talk about the civil rights movement being influenced by the Red Scare or Supreme Court decisions that sort of affected it one way or the other. But we don't really talk about the fact that the reason why is that when you put a bunch of generals, Buck Turgidson, in charge of every aspect of American life, you end up with that those people have idiotic views on foreign policy, and they also have idiotic views about domestic policy. Those are off a piece. But we don't want to admit that because there are a lot of liberal and like left-ish, not really hawks in this country. You know, there's the Warner, John Dolan, famously once said, that's a person with who thinks he has relatively good politics, and I have to take him at his word, keeps saying that he's an old school nationalist. He wants America to kick butt out there. And that's a really common view, even for people who think of themselves as not right wing.
I'm reminded now of a military tactics or military history class I took in my senior year of college. A class that I nearly canceled until I realized the day of that, oh, I would actually need it to graduate that semester, and I could not do that. But it occurred to me at the time, this was 2014, that like the people seeking out this class probably did not share my views on the military and the use thereof. And, you know, I couldn't help but examine the coursework through that lens. I think I ended up writing a paper on how Obama's drone warfare program was unconstitutional and illegal, and I got a good grade on it, so who knows. But tangent aside, I think there is something really to that self-selection that you're describing. This is also like the thesis of Noam Chomsky's work about manufacturing dissent or consent. Sorry.
If you manufacture consent by necessity, I think you're also manufacturing dissent.
Yeah. The idea being that the New York Times or these elite media institutions don't really have to engage in outright censorship because there's a selection bias in terms of who they're going to hire in the first place, who is going to seek out jobs at these outlets in the first place, and the sorts of mindsets that shape that. You know, they know enough to not say the thing that will get them censored for the most part. I think maybe there's an argument that this dynamic has broken down in the last decade or so. There is a bit more of seeming chaos in the media sphere where people are pushing those limits and not taking those assumptions for granted. But nevertheless, it's a dynamic that dominated for, you know, decades of American life.
Yeah, and one of the more frustrating aspects of that, of being a like objectively marginalized viewpoint as a leftist, is that anyone to your right, anyone to the right of us, treats us as insane people. And they always talk about horseshoe theory and how people on the left are exactly the same as people on the right, without ever examining why that's not true. Like, if they were the same, exactly the same, then there really wouldn't be a left or a right. Like, you know, that would just be a circle, but that's not how things work. And it's really frustrating because there, if you ever pay attention to politics outside of the U.S., you'll see that there are usually pretty varied viewpoints as far as, you know, political goals and ideology. But not in the U.S. Like, everything is super narrow and center right at the leftiest, by and large. And I think that's partly because we have such a long history of excluding anything slightly radical and boiling it down to individual actions rather than systemic problems, if that makes sense.
This is, I was watching a video on that greatest villain of the 2020s, cancel culture. We don't need to get into what most of the video was about, but one point that I actually found quite salient is that it was an essay in The Baffler by James Pogue called On the Rudeness of Mobs, and it made the point that during the Revolutionary War, mob justice was weaponized by the Patriots as a way to sort of maintain cohesion and stop people paying taxes to the British or saying pro-British things or so on, even before the war broke out. They would be subject to humiliation, economic ruin, exile, banishment, that kind of thing. And obviously, if the cause of the colonists was so righteous, and this is something that the U.S. would say about plenty of marginalized people everywhere, why was there such opposition to it that they felt the need to do this? Why did the opposition not simply disappear in the face of their blazingly bright logical arguments, right? And it's because this is a country founded on a central hypocrisy. It's a country that wanted to be based on life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for a class of slave owners. It has always been founded on that historical contradiction, and it's an explicit historical contradiction. We're not talking here, as bad as every colonial empire in the history of the earth has been, most of them did not pretend to be a liberal republic from the get. So this country has always been founded on that tension, and every successive generation of Americans has gotten angrier and angrier at anybody who would presume to make them relieve that tension, to make them untie that knot. They don't want to, because to do so would be to admit that the national project of the United States is absurd on its face. It requires the enslavement of marginalized people while using freedom and liberty as watchwords. It's fundamentally silly.
I think it's worth going into some of the history of the Red Scare here, because as I mentioned before, there's a condensed version that gets taught in high school history class. You know, there isn't enough time in high school history class to go into the depths of everything in American history. But the Red Scare, you hear about it in high school history class. You probably remember Joseph McCarthy, "Have You No Sense of Shame, Sir?" And maybe you got something about like Alger Hiss and how communists in Hollywood were being weeded out at the time. But those are the two facts you would be taught because they might come up on a test. And really, to a large degree, the Red Scare in the U.S., the second Red Scare, if we're being truthful, was a labor story. Unions had a great deal of power in the United States in the 1930s and 40s. With the passage of the NLR, National Labor Relations Act, in 1935, with growing union density in fields like manufacturing, especially auto manufacturing, you were seeing unions flex their muscle all through World War II. You know, even when they had signed no strike pledges for the course of the war, union members went on and had strikes themselves because they knew they could get better than the wages and conditions they were being offered. And so in response to that, you see, obviously, there's this social campaign to weed out socialist and communist influence in American society. But you also see stuff like the Taft-Hartley Act, which put into legislation that unions could not have these sorts of subversive elements in their ranks if they wanted to keep their newfound legitimacy. And a lot of unions did, and the result is something that we've talked about on Punching Out at great length, of how unions themselves took a more compromisational pose for the decades that followed. That's the word I'm choosing.
We can just call them cowards. It's fine.
Another law that I came across in researching for this episode is something that we haven't discussed on Punching Out before, and something that, frankly, I had been unfamiliar with until doing this research. There was a law in New York passed in 1949 called the Feinberg Law, which required teachers in New York State to sign an oath pledging that they would not be members of groups advocating for the violent overthrow of the government. This is effectively, you know, a loyalty oath, something which I think has a negative connotation these days, but was very common during this era. And it's something that resulted in a lot of teachers being excluded from the position of teaching, which I think we're seeing echoes of today. And it's something that, like, I have more history on if we want to dive deeper into that, into this segment. But at here, I've run out of breath.
I'm sure Noah has nothing to say about teachers ever, but particularly taking loyalty oaths. It's worth pointing out that there were, I think, five organizations, too, that were called to speak before the passage of this law, correct? And I think one of them was, like, the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, the International Workers something or another. And then, like, it was the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party as well. Mm-hmm. And I think one more I'm forgetting. But
I've got nothing to say about that either.
Yeah, absolutely nothing. Noah has zero opinion on any of this. So it's not like the groups that were being targeted here were right and left, and just generally anybody who might be overthrowing, like, if whatever version of the Proud Boys existed back then or similar, they weren't being called forth to testify and talk about the effects of this law. It was just the left. So this was very specifically targeting a certain political view.
By the way, this is from a Harvard Crimson article. There's a reason I'm bringing this up. This is a Harvard Crimson article from June 20th, 1950. New York courts ponder Feinberg Law Act would bar teachers belonging to groups on subversive lists. That's not how you write a headline. Harvard must not be that good. And there's no writer attributed, which is very interesting. But the most important bit, and more proof that maybe Harvard isn't worth anything, is that it says five organizations, but you got all of them. It only lists four.
Okay, I thought I was losing it, but no. Yeah.
No. In particular, the Nationalist Party of Puerto Rico is a particularly interesting inclusion there, given that shortly after this Feinberg Law was being discussed in October of 1950, there would be an uprising led by the Nationalist Party in Puerto Rico, in Jayuya and Utuado, which are central mountain towns. And the United States deployed the National Guard to bomb Puerto Ricans. It is the, well, until the Obama administration and its drone warfare program, it is the only time the United States had bombed American citizens. It was, anyway. There are things that you are allowed to be in American political discourse. You are allowed to say that the U.S. is mistreating certain sectors of its population. That's fine. You're allowed to advocate to some degree for things to be better, as long as it doesn't involve spending more money or taxing anybody or, God forbid, taking money away from the military or the police. The one thing you will never be allowed to do, the one thing that is always going to be threatening, and we are seeing it more powerfully than ever in this present moment, the one thing you will never be allowed to do is to say that the United States should not direct the affairs of the rest of the world. If any of your political positions aim in that direction, if any of them aim in the idea that the United States is not the first benevolent empire in world history that has always sought nothing but peace and joy for the inhabitants of the entire world, not just its own, out of the pure goodness of its freedom-loving ego heart, that is when you are going to get the hammer of the law and culture and every right-wing paramilitary effort thrown at you. That is when the Proud Boys are going to be out in force. That is when things will be made up about your people and the members of your movements. That is when you will be characterized as an agent provocateur or suborned by a foreign power.
That's when, like, Project Veritas will show up at your office with a camera in hand, you know, trying to gin up some controversy where one doesn't currently exist.
Apparently, you just throw a milkshake at them, and that's immediate defeat.
I think maybe this is a good point to take a break. When we can come back, we can talk about some of the ways in which this long legacy of the Red Scare is being felt in present-day workers' lives. We'll be back.
You're listening to Punching Out on WAYO-LP Rochester. If you'd like to continue slacking off, you can find all of our past episodes on iTunes and SoundCloud. Remember, your boss isn't listening, but we are.
Welcome back to Punching Out. I'm Ryan, joined still by Noah.
Still hi, y'all.
And Lou.
Hey, guys.
Noah, you've promised us some linguistics, something or other, and the suspense is simply killing me. What's going on?
Here's the thing. Something I didn't realize until we were recording the episode. It's called the Red Scare. The communists were not the ones doing the scaring. Like, in any other country, we would call this something like the Purge of Communists or something like that. Or, you know, I guess the U.S. doesn't tend to, like, identify its factions by color so easily. But in almost anywhere else, it would be called the White Terror. So it's wild to me that we treat this historical phenomenon by identifying it with its victims as the agents of terror when they were the ones being hounded out of their jobs, out of the country in some cases, or being, you know, forced into hiding.
Yeah, it's the framing of it justifies the actions very much so. And it's, I would definitely say that contributes to its lingering effects and why we still are so shy of any kind of leftist ideology in this country. Like, I talked off before we started recording about how in the sixth grade we had this like comparative government thing where the gotcha in the end was communism doesn't seem so bad, does it? And we were all supposed to go like, oh my gosh, you're right, communism isn't so bad. The problem is the people who wield communism, they're the real problems. So like, it's pervasive, this anti-communist thing that, you know, 11 and 12 year olds are expected to identify that it's bad.
We talked in the first segment about a law in New York State called the Feinberg Law, which was used to rid the teaching elements of radicalism and, you know, subversives of a few different stripes.
Ryan, are you
what's going on?
About to have to be forcefully ejected from your place of residence? Are they coming for you?
Oh no, that's just our like buzzer, like somebody's calling up to the apartment.
Uh huh. Are they FBI agents?
Not to my knowledge, though. Anything is possible.
They're listening.
Fraser Crane's an FBI agent now?
Cannot get into that. The direction I was going to go in actually harkens back to something that longtime Punching Out listeners will be familiar with. Sarah Jaffe's book, Work Won't Love You Back. I feel like I haven't had many good excuses to bring this up in recent episodes. But chapter in this book about the teaching profession in the United States and the history thereof, and particularly from a labor perspective. And she talks about how in the 30s and 40s, teaching in the U.S. was a profession that allowed racial and ethnic minorities like African Americans and Jews to achieve a middle class lifestyle because public sector jobs were some of the few ones where they could get reliably hired. In the private sector, their job prospects were officially and unofficially very limited, but the public sector had a modicum of rules that allowed them to be hired effectively. And so in New York, the teachers union was heavily Jewish, for example, and all throughout the South, segregated schools had, you know, segregated teaching ranks as well. She describes the effects of the Red Scare on the teaching ranks and how these sorts of, you know, the racial makeup of the teaching force was used as a cudgel against it, as, you know, one more reason to be concerned about these radicals siphoning off the public dime and, you know, educating your children to hate America, which is how we get to the subject of our second segment here, which is the effects all of this is having here in the present day, because that sort of rhetoric, that fear that racial and ethnic and other minorities are infiltrating the teaching ranks in order to propagandize and indoctrinate your students, seems to have reared its ugly head once again in our current moment of American history.
You know, far be it from me to do cheap guilt by association tactics, but don't you find it a little curious that whenever we have a massive hate campaign against educators and intellectuals and anybody who might tell you that actually the things that you know are not correct, there's also like a greater acceptance of like open anti-Semitism? It's weird how those correlate, right? It's not just me.
Yeah, it's definitely curious. I think if you're a listener of Punching Out, you're familiar with the ways in which these sorts of what's called conspiracy theories are prevalent in movements to rid leftist or liberal or quote unquote woke elements from society. There is a definite underpinning of anti-Semitic nonsense that goes into a lot of this. You know, the idea that the Jews are orchestrating things and, you know, cannot be trusted. You know, they're feeding your kids liberalism and socialism and worse, wokeism.
I do have to say, I think I prefer being labeled as woke to being labeled an egghead. So that is a slight improvement in how these things have gone, but not by much. And there's the reason that I'm bringing this up is because the most notable effect that this... We really need to come up with an alternative name for this. Calling it the Red Scare, now that I notice that, is just annoying. But that this continued attempt to stifle, eliminate, and prejudice against any ideology to the left of like a median Democrat, the most noticeable effect it's had is in the field of education, because conservatives have turned it into an open battlefield in their ongoing culture war.
Yeah, it's along with the pairing with anti-Semitism, this is also profoundly anti-intellectual. That, you know, I know Noah's talked at length about how there are huge swathes of the country that are proud of being ignorant and uneducated. And people who would argue with that are vilified. So often, as we are seeing now, teachers and anybody who works with children are targeted as avenues through which children could be shown like a wider world, or, you know, properly educated. Because I would argue that, you know, what teachers are asked to do in states like Florida is not education. I don't know what you would call it, to be perfectly honest, but education it is not.
Yeah, I think it's worth getting into what's going on in Florida specifically. It's happening in a lot of states, to be clear, but Florida has come under probably the most scrutiny, in part because it's a very large state, it's the third most populous, and in part because of Ron DeSantis's tremendously failed presidential campaign, which to a large degree was built on the foundation of his education policies, was built on the idea that he was the governor who was taking on woke teachers unions and taking on the teachers who would dare to bring up racism or sexism or being positive towards the LGBT community in classrooms. There was a bill called the, quote, Stop Woke Act and passed in Florida in 2022, which was designed to not just, you know, stifle discussions of these topics in schools, but also to once again weed out from classrooms the sorts of teachers who have, well, politics like ours or similar. If teachers played along by the rules, that was great. But if they violated the rules and found themselves fired, even better, I think was part of the logic at play.
Interestingly enough, it wasn't just you would be fired. It would be you would be criminally prosecuted in Florida. So if you had a book that wasn't approved on their list of books that you could have in a school, you would face felony charges.
And in some of these, not only felony charges, but I believe also like sex offender registration. Because there has been an explicit push to label teachers talking about anything like sexual orientation, gender identity, reproductive rights or justice, anything, basically anything that allows a kid to know when a bad thing is happening to them. Anything that might arm a child with some kind of independence and control over their bodily autonomy is being labeled as grooming. And I said to Lou before we started recording that when you try to avoid ableist vocabulary, right? And given the job that I do, who can say what that is? I don't believe in things like IQ. I don't believe in things like intelligence being any kind of innate quality or permanent quality or anything like that. And when you find this kind of stuff, it makes it very hard to have a term to call DeSantis voters, because CHUD at some point just gets old and you want something else. And I don't know what to call a person who is so full of themselves that they are perfectly aware that they are willfully ignorant of American history, that they don't know anything, that they don't want to know anything, they don't want to learn anything, and would still believe, and this is the coup de grace for me, they would believe when Ron DeSantis says, you're a brave defender of the American child. You 65-year-old retiree with no children in the public school system, you are the one I'm deputizing to go to that board meeting and yell at somebody who knows way more about the subject than you do. You absolutely know better than they do. They have, it's not just that they have a degree, they have spent years studying this, they've gone to conferences, whatever. None of that is worth anything. You know better than them because in your heart you believe the United States is good and that's enough. To be so full of yourself that you fall for that hook, line, and sinker, you should have to wear a sign everywhere saying, scam me, grift me, I deserve it.
I want to quote a bit from a Guardian article which deals with some teachers and how they're grappling with the new rules that govern what they can and cannot do in their workplaces, in their classrooms. Quote, many teachers complain that Florida's 67 counties have different and often conflicting standards on which books are to be removed from schools. For nearly a year, Duval County removed a biography of Roberto Clemente, a pioneering Afro-Puerto Rican baseball star who faced discrimination. DeSantis and his education commissioner overruled that decision and ordered the book restored. DeSantis said there is no book banning in Florida. Florida law calls for removing pornographic and inappropriate materials, and among the books removed from high schools have been Slaughterhouse-Five, The Kite Runner, Forever by Judy Blume, and Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye. Three of those four I read in high school. I'm just going to note, schools have banned many books about gays. Such moves even make these books unavailable to advanced placement students taking college-level English courses. Several counties have banned Antangle Makes Three, an illustrated children's book about two male penguins in New York's Central Park that raise a baby penguin together. There is literally a plot in Parks and Rec about, you know, outrage over gay penguins. It is kind of jarring to read that sentence, having watched that TV show.
I think it was based on those penguins. That's how long the backlash has been going on for. Anytime there's anything, no matter how innocuous, that might imply something other than the 1950s boomer ideal of the white picket fence and the 2.3 children might not be all there is to life. There are a lot of people in this country who get incredibly hemorrhoidally mad about it.
I also, like, side note, I'm not getting into it, I promise. I have a pet theory about how Parks and Rec is like the harbinger of all things bad that have happened in the past 8 years. I love that show when it came out, but we're not getting into it now.
We'll just let it hang in the air. Just let it linger.
We all know it was the Cubs winning the World Series that did it.
It's striking in revisiting Work Won't Love You Back, the parallels here, because it's noted here that in the 1940s, the teachers' union fought for the rights of women teachers, including the right to marry and remain in the classroom, something that was banned in many states up until World War II. Teaching a profession that was dominated by women in the U.S. for effectively because they were cheap labor at the time, and not really the case in other countries. But those women were expected to adhere to certain standards about their out-of-work behavior and their personal lives in a way that has echoes in, you know, who's allowed to say that they're married in Florida public schools today.
You know, we were talking about at the beginning of the episode about how government employees in particular are self-selected for their, you know, being right and everything. But I would say that there is no profession more restricted in as far as their out of work activities than teachers. Like nobody else has to keep as tight a lid on what they actually think. Unless you're right. Like we all had that one really weird teacher in school who was just perhaps a little bit too conservative for, you knew they liked to say some slurs when they got a chance to, but you could not be left. You can't be anywhere close to having, you know, a sexual identity. That's not 100% normal. And by normal, I mean heteronormative. Like teachers have it worse. And that's why they're easy targets, both during McCarthyism and now, in that nobody is going to really argue for the teachers.
Yeah. I keep coming back to the fact that teaching combines two of the things Americans hate the most. And we know this, especially since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. The two things Americans, most Americans, across political stripes, hate the most, the two things they will not stand, is you telling them something they don't know and telling them that they don't know it. And they will absolutely not stand being made to feel like somebody is smarter than them and can tell them what to do. And so you end up with a country that is uniquely unprepared to deal with any threat it can't shoot. So you know, we are where we are in the pandemic situation, and at the same time, we're deciding to externalize all of the actual bad things that are happening. Like, imagine if these people in Florida that are, you know, going to these school board meetings, imagine if they used all that energy on, I don't know, complaining about price gouging in grocery stores. They're mostly old. Somebody might pay attention to that. That might actually get some political capital. They tend to be people with money. Oh, wait, that's why they don't care. They have all the time in the world and all the energy in the world in their, you know, advanced age to go and show up to yell and externalize what they see as their quote-unquote country falling apart onto a target that has been painted for them. And that to me is the ultimate irony of it all, that any right-wing politician can just say some magic words and conjure an army of some combo of like Proud Boys and former Gamer Gators and Tiki Torch types and Angry Boomers to immediately just point them that way. And all of these people are convinced that they are true individuals, that they are free thinkers, that they are the ones who are not seduced by, you know, critical race theory or wokeism or whatever other BS they heard from Christopher Rufo in the last week. It's absurd. It beggars belief that you can hold both of those things in your mind at the same time.
Yeah, I do think it's worth just making explicit the point that all of these recent panics, and panic is maybe the best term for them, about critical race theory or DEI, they are all different faces of the same effort. They are all part of a concerted campaign to undermine public education in the U.S., to undermine teachers' unions at public education facilities, to undermine the power of teachers as workers and in their communities, to have some influence over the children under their supervision. Because, you know, if we're going to go far enough back, this push stems from desegregation and the ideas that white suburban children will have to receive the same education as black inner city kids, a situation that a lot of parents in the United States simply will not tolerate. And so we've seen a rise of private and charter schools that find one way or another to keep their rosters lily white, to get around the rules that are now in place about schools can't legally segregate by race. And so if they can undermine public schools, if they can make public schools look bad, if they can say to conservative parents that public schools are indoctrinating your kids to hate you, they can, you know, bring back in practice, if not, you know, officially under the law, what they feel they lost in Brown versus Board Education.
And all of the reactions to that are surface level reactions or surface level observations to what is ultimately economic systems that are created to support capitalism.
So how do we tie a bow on this segment here? Because we focused on education in this segment in large part because that's where, you know, I saw the parallels between this long Red Scare idea, and I know, Noah, that you don't care for that term anymore, and, you know, what workers are facing in the present day. But, you know, certainly it exists in other fields. I brought up Project Veritas earlier, the how would we describe them? The conservative propaganda outlet that likes to find rogue public officials saying modestly liberal things in order to oust them from their positions. You know, there is like a whole media apparatus really and now in some states a legal apparatus to try and get teachers and public officials fired for their modestly left-wing beliefs. And that has created, for many people, a culture of, you know, hesitancy at the very least about how open you're willing to be about your politics, how open you're willing to be about your beliefs that, say, actually gay people have a right to exist and be happy like the rest of us, or other beliefs.
Yeah, I joked previously when we were planning this that we need DEI, but for political beliefs, even though DEI is now on the chopping blocks for everything for being too woke already. Because it's not good enough to stop at like liberalism. We need to be more open about what a world could look like and like talk about aspirational thinking. One of the arguments that liberals often have against leftists is that we're not realistic and that we couldn't really have a world in which people are actually free and equal. That's not a realistic thing. Let's like do what could actually be done, which is why we're going to ask for like tiny incremental steps to, you know, gatekeep some factor that should be a universal right. And I think we need to be more secure and talk more openly about what the world really could look like and start talking and breaking down assumptions that people have about how the world works.
I will point out here, part of the conservative movement now features a talking point about quote unquote viewpoint diversity in educational outlets. The people who successfully ousted Harvard's black woman president over plagiarism claims that probably don't hold up to muster are all about viewpoint diversity and the idea that conservatives must have a place in the professorships of Harvard and Penn and, you know, the sorts of schools that they would donate to if only there wasn't, you know, pesky DEI programs muddying up the waters.
And we have to be very loudly in saying that by what they're saying there, they mean they need to be the only voice. That's what they actually mean. They don't mean that there should be diversity. They think that all diversity should be silenced in favor of them, which is why every single time one of them gets in hot water, they go on several platforms to talk about how they are being silenced. What they are saying does not match reality, and we must continue to point that out over and over and over again.
Yeah, this reminds me of something that people have said about Trump. They said it about Musk. They said it about all of these different billionaires. And I think it is an anchoring issue for the right wing. I really didn't want to call it a disease. But it is this desire to not just have your own views and be left alone for them, but to have them be respected. It's not enough for Elon Musk to have a ton of money making products that kill people and set themselves on fire and rust even though they're made out of stainless steel and can't do any of the things they're supposed to do and have a 50% success rate, so on and so on and so on. It's not enough for Trump to be a billionaire. Well, possibly not anymore.
Ish.
Yeah, exactly. And basically be legally immune from almost any consequence other than money. You know, the massive record that he's got of grifting and betraying people and so on has only just come back to bite him, and who knows if that's going to hold. So it's not enough for them. They want respect. If anything unites the right wing, all the different sectors from the Mitt Romney to the farthest right Richard Spencer and so on, it is that pathological need to be acknowledged as important, as respectable, as a voice that should be in the room, even though the things you are saying and the things that you believe in any world that made sense would be abhorrent, so you need to reshape the entire world so that your beliefs now fit comfortably closer to the middle. And frankly, the American liberals and Democrats, especially in terms of foreign policy, are making that, they are paving that road all the way through. They are running out every piece of construction equipment to make that road as smooth as humanly possible. They think they're not, but it is what they are doing. American Democrats in 2024 are possibly, in my adult life, the most conservative they have ever been. They don't think they are, because they think, you know, I support gay marriage and I support some mild police reforms and I'm okay with unions existing and so on, and I'm okay with teachers and so on and so on and so on. But in terms of the approach that they have mentally, they aren't that much different from those weirdos over there.
I think what you're seeing in the various panics over education, be it at the K through 12 level or in higher education, is I described it as part of a project to dismantle public education earlier, and that is true, but it also fits hand in glove with the broader, like, conservative rhetoric. I don't know if you've seen the freak out about Google's AI thing spitting out images of like racially diverse Nazis and racially diverse American founding fathers, and the sense that is now commonplace on the right that big tech through woke AI systems are going to dominate our lives down the line. There's a fear there that is so hard to square with reality, as Noah, you put it, that, you know, the idea that these companies, Google and Microsoft, are, we've talked in the past on Punching Out about rainbow washing and, you know, companies burnishing their images with, you know, efforts to be inclusive towards gay and trans members of their, employees and so on and so forth, and the ways in which that falls short and nevertheless gets decried as the most heinous, you know, brainwashing and indoctrination by the cuckoos on the right. And you're seeing it again with this AI freakout, because I think if you're listening to Punching Out, you recognize that the ChatGPTs and whatever Google's product is called aren't really capable of taking over the world the way that the profiteers behind them are pitching them. And at the same time are nowhere near, like, the reason Google's AI spits out racially diverse Nazis is because it doesn't know anything about anything, and it's very stupid, and it's broken and busted. It's not really an effort to diversify the world and to erase white men from history. But sometimes those two things kind of look the same if you're wearing bad glasses, I guess. I guess the point I'm getting at here is that there are real problems in society, and it is frustrating and baffling to watch a well-funded media and legal and political apparatus so consistently misdiagnose them on purpose. And, you know, to some degree, that is the broader lesson of Punching Out from every episode, but I'm running out of steam.
Yeah, but that is the point, that people are deliberately misunderstanding what is going on to fit their own needs, and their own ends are selfish and short-sighted. And we have to do better. We just have to.
I think maybe the point to better sum up my last ramble is that, you know, they have this vision of corporate leadership as, you know, mastermindful, woke, you know, revolutionaries, when in fact they're just kind of morons. And if you can't tell the difference between those things, like, you're going to misdiagnose everything that you encounter.
And if you can't tell the difference between those two things, why should we trust your judgment on anything? It's not hard. It really isn't. I'm tired of making excuses for the worst people in this country, for the worst people in the universe, and pretending because everybody has, you know, a racist uncle that they want to hang out with once in a blue moon, or has somebody that they don't want to argue with at Thanksgiving. I'm tired of giving these people all the slack in the world. Some of us have never had the feeling that we had any. Some of us have always felt that we are one single mistake away from permanent penury, from being cut off from any kind of, not just success, but any kind of stability or security in any material term. And meanwhile, some idiot in Florida whose view of the world is asinine is constantly getting defended, not just by his co-religionaries on the right, but even by people who pity him in the center and the left. That world is backwards.
For this week, I'm Ryan.
I'm Lou.
I was Noah.
And this was Punching Out.
You've been listening to Punching Out. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Punching Out Wayo. Email us your work stories, complaints, and struggles to punchingoutwayo@gmail.com. Punching Out is a project of the Punching Out Collective. Our producer is Ryan Brister. Music for Punching Out is provided by Ariel Cruz. Tune in next week for more Punching Out, and remember, your boss isn't listening, but we are.